We are not alone. It is not only your life that you're living. This is something I realized, particularly during this practice period. I've been realizing as I'm growing in my continuous mindfulness how much self monopolizes my thinking. And how narrow that feels. With the practice period, I've been doing a gratitude reflection, not only at the end of the day, but also during the day. And I've just really been flooded by the realization that I couldn't possibly live this life if there weren't a million bazillion people making that possible pretty much in every minute. I mean, really. Everywhere around me. And the thing is that even small things like walking up a path and seeing autumn leaves, or I've gotten to relocate a mouse family of seven. And there were a number of babies, and they were pretty much the size of a cotton ball. And it wasn't just a, that's a mouse, I'm a person affair. Watching a cotton ball size baby mouse go up a set of stairs just about broke my heart. They're almost unbearably cute. And they're just so matter of fact. You know, it's just boink, dun 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 dun, boink, dun 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 dun. And you know, whatever they can chew open for food, they will. And sometimes they fall into trash cans because they boink down and instead of the floor. I mean, they're just sort of amazing. So I realize, you know, this just isn't only my life. It's not only your life. Now I'm 67, so one of the questions that came up was, well, what will I do with the rest of this life, mine or anybody else's, and what am I doing with the life and mine? And the answer that came first was, enjoy your life. And I realized, you know, this self-monopolization thing is kind of tiring. Have you ever noticed that? It's not, well, I can't say that it's not interesting, but you know, there's probably at least a few other people in here that have done something equivalent to binge-watching television. And so it's like you're paying attention, you're not disinterested, but you kind of know by, you know, episode 20 or whatever, that this isn't really alive for you anymore. You know, there's just in some way you're just kind of getting through the whole thing. Not everybody is like me, so maybe that's not the way you binge watch, or maybe you're smart enough not to binge watch. But I hope you can relate to what I'm saying when I say it's narrow to be involved in that way. And it's not that easy to enjoy your life when you're mostly thinking about mostly you. I've been realizing how blind I am to the impact of my thoughts and words and deeds. And you never really know. You're just a condition. So I do work at the Rush City Prison one or two times a month. And I wanted to teach them loving kindness, which is an antidote to anger, which we all have, but they've got even more reason to have it in their life than we do, for the most part. So I led them through a 50-minute guided meditation on loving kindness. Well, some people loved it, and some people got angry. And as I left the prison, it suddenly really hit me. I thought, wow, I completely did the opposite of what I was intending to do for those people that got angry. I was trying to teach them about the wonderfulness of loving kindness, and I actually created the conditions for them to become angry. Now, that's technically not totally my thought, because I'm not just living my life, right? I'm living life with everything. I mean, it's somewhat questionable that there's an I there, right? Just what is this I that's doing this living? But putting that aside, I just realize more and more, as I'm more attuned to this isn't just my life, that even really tiny things reverberate in other lives. If I smile at people, if I don't smile at people, if I get a little edgy or testy or restless, if I don't get enough sleep and then I kind of bonk out and I'm not present, if I pay close attention and I notice something that I respond to in a helpful way that's not been requested, if I actually listen, those all have incredible reverberations. I don't know where they all go. And it's not just people. I got up the other morning, and this is just a good idea, good example. So I said at the beginning of the practice period that I would get up and come in at 6 o'clock every day except Monday and do my sitting and hope that others would join me. And some of that's happened. And on my way to do that the other morning, I hadn't slept well, my own fault, and I really didn't want to get up, and I just thought, but I promise, so I'm going to do it, and you know it's going to be good for you. And I walked out of the back door of the house, and I looked up just briefly while I wasn't sort of stewing. By this time I'd gotten beyond stewing and said, just do it. You know, the solution to not wanting to do it is to just do it. And I looked up, and right there, a full moon before dawn makes me cry just to think of it. It's like, why would it make me want to cry? What's the big deal about the moon? But it does. It does. It's just like, right? It's just, do you ever not want to look at the moon? How does that, you know, so that's part of my life now. And I was awake to it. Right? But I'm not, there's a lot that I'm not awake to. So there's, I realize how really to appreciate and enjoy your life, you need to be awake. At some level, you need to be awake. And so that's really motivated my mindfulness practice. I've been teaching an anger class, and we're using a text from Thich Nhat Hanh. And he, you know, has such a lovely way of very positively motivating me and many others. And he says, just take one mindful breath. Then to stabilize it, do several more. But he says, as long as you can do mindful breathing or mindful walking, you can take care of your anger. You can take care of anything, I'd like to report. And that's what is really needed, it turns out, to enjoy your life. And to be there, to be awake for it. And it turns out there's an interesting relationship between gratitude and anger. Gratitude is one of three antidotes for anger, along with generosity and loving kindness. So I have for a long time thought of those as, you know, sort of aspirin for anger. But I'm realizing with this, oh, it's not just my life I'm living. And with the thought that what I might want to do between now and the time I die is enjoy my life, make that kind of a, you know, it's like, well, of course, we all want to be happy. We all want to enjoy our lives. There's that kind of enjoy my life. But it's different than saying, I want on my tombstone for it to say, she really enjoyed her life. It's different to say, every day, I want to enjoy this life that's not just mine. And it turns out that practicing generosity and gratitude and loving kindness really helps that. If we go back to classic Buddhist teachings, the first noble truth really is to penetrate the truth of suffering, which is to really, as I did when I went to the prison, to really reverberate with the vibration of remorse around unskillfully, but humanly, causing conditions that gave rise to anger for some people that I care about and who I want to help get over anger. Just see, well, I didn't mean it, but it happened that way. I was part of that living. And the second noble truth is essentially to renounce the causes of suffering. When we are cultivating generosity, cultivating gratitude, cultivating loving kindness, we're essentially inoculating ourselves against aversion and desire and ignorance. It's more than just a quick fix when something I don't want in my life, aversion, arises. It's a necessary condition for enjoying my life. It sounds kind of simple, like I think I already knew this. But my experience of it is, it's one thing to think I understand and know it in my head, and it's a different thing to purposefully cultivate it. You know, part of the Eightfold Path is right effort, Right? Effort is to, when something unwholesome arises, to essentially renounce what's needed to be renounced, let go of, allow, and to penetrate that noble truth of unwholesomeness in such a way that you can become skillful in preventing it before it arises. Cultivating generosity, gratitude, and loving kindness is a vaccine. It's harder for a happy, enjoying mind to generate irritable thoughts. Still very possible, I'd like to report. Impermanence. Permanence is part of the first noble truth. So with an appreciation that this isn't just my life I'm living, a more subtle penetration of the first noble truth, what causes suffering. Now I can include in my loving kindness phrases, may I know the causes of and cultivate happiness. May I know the causes of and renounce the causes of suffering. If I did nothing but that for the rest of my life, I would be very happy. I'm not entirely willing to go the whole way on that yet. But I now actually can recommend it wholeheartedly. And I now have a different kind of energy about renunciation. You know, there's all the things we love. Just rice crackers, you know. Having this particular cup this way, you know. Having clean bathrooms. Getting letters from friends. I mean, there's so many things that each day as I have noticed more and more, how many things I'm averse to, how often aversion comes up during the day. And not everybody's like that, you know. There's plenty of people that don't have that as a more probable condition, but there's still a hunk of people that are like that. So what I notice is that my monopolization with myself is, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, you know, we have such a training around pursuing happiness by pursuing getting things or avoiding things. And we kind of know that, but boy, when you start getting really mindful, you can just see how much energy that takes. It's like you're constantly, it's sort of like, I didn't used to have a car, now I have a used car, very used car. And it's like, oh, that's great. And then, but now I have to pay insurance, I don't worry about parking, you know. And just the other day, I went to close my door, and it wouldn't close. So, bang, bang, you know, it's a cold weather thing. And it's like, so there's just never any end to aversions. They just keep coming up. You know, there's always something that's not quite right. You know, if it's sunny, then it's too hot. Or I already put away my short sleeve shirts. Or, you know, whatever it is. But it takes its toll, right? And it's not just my life I'm living, right? When people are smiling, you've got to have people in your life that make you smile almost every time you see them. There's just something about their energy that does that. And in my case, you know, meeting me can be kind of sobering. You know, it's kind of like, well, you know, she's certainly serious, you know. One person once told me early in my Zen career, "You're so dark." You know? And I can't say that I disagreed with that, but I was really happy that I could just be in a place where somebody would say that to me and it wouldn't, you know, knock me over. So this focus on the things that irritate you, I mean, it's like we're all a big immune system, right? You know, it's like we're always looking for something that's not going right and trying to fix it, coming in to rescue it from being averse. And that's just, it's really hard to enjoy life when you're doing that all the time. So this shift to saying, I think I'm going to concentrate on the cultivation of loving kindness, you know, gratitude and generosity. And it turns out that when I do that, this mindfulness thing, I also need forgiveness. I really need forgiveness so that I don't kind of swing from being obsessed with myself to hating myself. Because that's, you know, it's just really two sides of the coin. I can, my ex-husband used to say, whatever you do, don't make it about yourself. You know, it's like, and I had a friend, you know, it was like I had done something and she pointed it out and I felt deep remorse, but I kind of jumped off the remorse cliff, you know, and at that point, it really doesn't matter what I'm feeling remorse-wise because it doesn't really get through to that person. It really does become all about me. So this all about me thing, it turns out, really is helped by this realization, oh, this isn't just my life I'm living. You know, the look on my face, even really small things can reverberate. And if I'm paying attention, then I can see that. And I can steer differently. So, some thoughts I have from particularly the anger class. Thich Nhat Hanh says, the tools we need for aversion, and in particular anger, are mindful breathing, mindful walking, mindful lying down, although he's not as big on that as mindful walking and mindful breathing. Embracing our anger, embracing our aversion. Then looking deeply at my perceptions and at the other. Their suffering, the kind of help they might need. And he basically says, just practice those, and that will help you with anger. So we started out our class with just what triggers, just write down something in your own life. So this is the Start Where You Are program, right? Write down something that triggers anger. And in doing that, what we were able to identify and see clearly was, oh, a trigger is something different than the whole story in the evaluation. So there were a couple of people that wrote down, this person that I work with that's lazy, that's irresponsible, who's really irritating and who, you know, is really ruining my life at work. That's not the trigger. That's what we're thinking about the trigger, whatever that might be. So at the prison, the trigger was a 50-minute loving kindness meditation without a warning that it was going to be 50 minutes. That was the trigger. The thinking that went along with that for some people was, wow, this is great. If I'd known in advance, it would have been totally different. So it was really great in the end. They didn't put in the end, but you could hear in the end, you know. But for the people that felt anger, they would have said, you made me do a meditation. You know, that would be an evaluative way of looking at it. So we started parsing for ourselves. Okay, let's separate out. What's the trigger? Just the observation, the thing that happened. I got stuck in traffic might be an example, right? Versus the evaluation. Why does everybody have to go the same place at the same time, right? It doesn't have to be reasonable. When I first started dealing with triggers and evaluations, I was, well, feelings and needs. I remember the only need I could seem to identify initially was, because that's what I want. And formulating a request was, give me what I want. You know, it was pretty straightforward. So what I asked the class to do was, first, find a way to separate out what the trigger was, and then what their story was around that, what they were telling themselves, what were the thoughts that were going through that. And then as we have been progressing, I asked them to take a look at, well, what were the feelings that came up with that anger? And could they, with the help of a feelings and needs list, associate it with a need? I said, please go home and do this homework to the best of your ability. And that's a pretty simple exercise, right? And it was astounding, really, what came back. One person had said, well, I don't really get angry much. I kind of understand what I need to do. But every now and then, I get angry. And that person, after going through that exercise, said, you know what? I thought I understood about my anger and what to do with it. But it turns out, after I went through this exercise, I don't at all. I get angry all the time. I was thinking I understood this, and I do in my head, but it's a different thing to actually do it. And was able to say, so one of the things is that when a person in my household speaks to me and it sounds like there's a judgment coming at me or a criticism, that's what I'm thinking when they say something. And when I'm thinking that, then I completely lose it. I completely lose everything I thought I understood about anger. Another person who had a person at work that was a problem said, you know, when I had to try to formulate a request for what I would ask this person to do differently, I stumbled upon the fact that, oh my gosh, really, it's not at all about this person. It's completely not about this person. It's about what I don't like at my work and how much fear I have about being able to enjoy my life. So this working with whatever comes up and being mindful of it in some very particular ways is literally life-changing. You can see in those two examples, the person who thought they kind of had anger down said, well, when is there meditation here? And I sat down with my spouse and I talked about my realization and I said, I would like to make peace around this. I would like to change this between us and I would like your help. This is big deal stuff. And once again, it's not just my life I'm living. Right? It's not just my life I'm living. That realization, who knows what will happen between that couple? Who knows what will happen because one person at work suddenly realized, oh, my perception, this is one of the skill sets that Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, looking deeply at my perceptions. We often misunderstand. We don't think we're misunderstanding, but that's why the deep looking is needed, because it's things we think we already know. It's things that we're blind to in one way or another. And when we kind of take a step back and say, well, maybe there's something I'm missing. Maybe there's something I'm not picking up on. Then what happens? We're living a different life. And we're living in connection. One of the things that happened at the prison was I was tired. I was scared. I'm always a little scared when I go up there. I was full of attachment to, can I transform their lives with loving kindness? That's a wonderful aim. But I was pretty attached to it. And I was trying to make something happen. So that just wasn't very skillful. But I was, I didn't fully take in the impact of that until I at least got to my car. And then I spent another week or so processing it. And, you know, it's still there. It's still there. It's kind of in the background. It's like, well, will the people that met come back? They don't know who's coming when, but they just stayed away for a month, you know. So I begin to realize, wow, there's a lot to enjoy, but there's also a lot of suffering to penetrate. And it's doable. It's doable if I just breathe and follow the basic instructions of Buddhist practice. I just have to stick with it. And I get so impatient so quickly. Just the other morning, I'd been given one of these things that you put it in water and then it kind of grows. Only, you know, it doesn't like grow like a plant. It's not a chia pet. It just gets bigger. And I just looked at it the other morning. I was like, I hate that. I just want to toss it out right now if somebody hadn't given it to me. You know, it's like, it's not reasonable. It's just, it just comes up, you know? And it's like, well, there you go again. You know, I was able to smile at it, right? I was able to smile at it. Other times, the best I can do is, and it's a pretty good thing to do, is there is suffering. Just there is suffering. And I'm going to be here for you, my suffering. I'm going to take care of you, my suffering. Thich Nhat Hanh in the anger book has just does such a lovely job. He says, your anger is your baby. Right? And he just has it so down. He has a lovely, let me just read you one thing from the, that's just sort of like everybody can relate to it. There we go. Chapter 2, where are you? I love this chapter. Cooking your anger, he says, you know, it's like raw potatoes. They don't taste very good. But if you cook them for a while, they can change. All right, so let's see. When someone says or does something that makes us angry, we suffer. We tend to say or do something back to make the other suffer with the hope that we will suffer less. We think, I want to punish you. I want to make you suffer because you have made me suffer. And when I see you suffer a lot, I will feel better. Is there anybody here that has not had this situation in their life at some point in time? Many of us are inclined to believe in such a childish practice. The fact is that when you make the other suffer, he will try to find relief by making you suffer more. The result is an escalation of suffering on both sides. It's not just my life I'm living. Both of you need compassion and help. Neither of you needs punishment. That's why forgiveness has to be in this. When you get angry, go back to yourself and take very good care of your anger. Is that like the first thing you think about when you get angry? Oh, I better take care of this. And when someone makes you suffer, go back and take care of your suffering, your anger. Do not say or do anything. Whatever you say or do in a state of anger may cause more damage in your relationship. Most of us don't do that. We don't want to go back to ourselves. We want to follow the other person in order to punish him or her. If your house is on fire, the most urgent thing to do is to go back and try to put out the fire, not to run after the person you believe to be the arsonist. If you run after the person you suspect has burned your house will burn down while you are chasing him or her. That is not wise. You must go back and put out the fire. But when you are angry, if you continue to interact with or argue with the other person, if you try to punish her, you are acting exactly like someone who runs after the arsonist while everything else goes up in flames. I mean, when you get irritable or, you know, pissed off, just on the, you know, watching the evening news or something like that, you don't think about this particular description. But when I read it, it's like, yeah, you're exactly right. And as he points out very early in it, he goes, to be happy is to suffer less. Many people look for happiness outside themselves. But if you observe carefully, you will see that many rich, famous people are not happy. And he ends this section by saying, in order to be free of anger, we have to practice. Whether we are Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, or Jewish, we cannot ask Buddha, Jesus, God, or Mohammed to take the anger out of us. We also can't ask children to wait for very long, so I'll finish up quickly. Taking the anger, they can't take the anger out of our hearts for us. So that's the fundamental practice, right? We need to change our hearts. When we are looking at our lives as my life, and you're getting in the way of my happiness, we have enemies. Without a change of heart, these tools aren't something we can use because we're too busy with our picture of unhappiness. So just do one thing, and that's work on being willing to be that happy. Work on including everybody in your heart.